De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So, hello. Thank you all for coming. My co-host and writing partner for Blowback, Brennan James, he could not be here. So the name of the session is a little bit unfair, Blowback Live, when I don't have the other half of Blowback here. However, I will be talking about Iraq today and the criminal invasion that our government launched just over 20 years ago. I'm going to talk specifically, however, about a more distant time, about the American relationship with Iraq. I'm going to talk about the American secret history of with Iraq, how we sold Iraq weapons before we destroyed Iraq over 15 years, and how all of it connects to some of the major political and economic shifts of the last half century. In fact, I think that the story of what we call neoliberalism or globalization is fundamentally incomplete unless we account for a bizarre matrix of corruption, anti-communism, and covert warfare that characterizes the story. In the last half century, the American forces of reaction have remapped and reconfigured our economy. Unionized labor has declined, inequality has widened, monopolies and cartels in software and finance rule the day. Another way to put it, from Jimmy Carter's and Reagan's America through the present day, deindustrialization has been selective. But the military industrial complex, because of its strategic importance to our government, has survived and even prospered, where so much else has withered. The USA remains, in my view, fundamentally a military state and society. And as Mao Zedong once phrased it, America is the boss of imperialism. That is, the military state and military society of ours has its energies directed at all times to maintaining our empire, to preserving the patterns of capital accumulation that structure our reality, and to do all this no matter the cost in human lives nor public shame. J.A. Hobson, the foundational British scholar of imperialism, asked the question, if imperialism arouses such discontent at home and abroad, and it ruins its country's reputation abroad, then why do it? And his response, I believe, stands the test of over 120 years. Quote, the only possible answer is that the business interests of the nation as a whole are subordinated to those of certain sectional interests that usurp control of the national resources and use them for their private gain. This is no strange or monstrous charge to bring. It is the commonest disease of all forms of government. Now, by the end of this talk, I hope that the relevance of this historical perspective is clear 20 years on from the invasion of Iraq. The American military machine remains the single largest and most deadly military force of its kind in human history. It has de jure and de facto control over swaths of the globe that the Romans literally did not even know existed. It is also a world historic capital suck, practically vacuuming money up and turning it into missiles, bullets, uniforms, and other accoutrements of war. And it's not just money that military machine engorges itself on. It's the rest of our government. The American State Department, ever since the catastrophic tenure of Secretary Dean Rusk during Vietnam, now merely serves as the Pentagon's handmaiden. I'd actually argue that the two most lasting contributions of any Secretary of State in the past 20 years were, one, Colin Powell's UN testimony with the fake vial before the Iraq invasion in 2003, and two, Hillary Clinton's catastrophic support for the downfall of the Gaddafi government in Libya, which transformed one of the most developed countries in Africa into a never-ending battleground. moving on to what is now the National Security Agency, which began life as the Armed Forces Security Agency in the 1940s. And even the mere existence of the rebranded NSA was not publicly revealed until 1975. It now operates a surveillance apparatus more powerful in reality than any cartoon caricature of the GDR's Stasi. But perhaps the worst of all this war machine mission creep has been the abject militarization of the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA's planning directorate, later called its Directorate of Operations, has never shied away from military activity. Training armies and creating secret services was their bread and butter. The Iranian SAVAK, the Afghan Mujahideen, the Pakistani ISI, the Contras, and the Syrian franchise of Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, these all bear the CIA's imprimatur, if not its literal weapons. But today the CIA has a well-lubricated killing machine that it operates in-house, an assassination program from the skies. In the 1980s, CIA officials talked about arming the Mujahideen as so-called techno-guerrillas. Well, the Predator drone, which was the CIA's baby, has become something like a techno air force. Yes, the agency still has its ostensible Jack Ryan types, intelligence analysts, the kinds of people who Richard Nixon once dismissively put it, just read newspapers all day and supply information that ends up in the president's daily intelligence briefing. But what's true for the rest of the government is true for the agency. At every point of its existence, but now more than ever, it is the spooks with body counts who command the most credibility within the corridors of power. If the tide of history ebbs and flows on the shores of class struggle, then I believe that militarism and militarization is something like the moon. The perpetual economy of war has been present at every turn, every bend in the river, every significant development of the new phase of global capitalism that emerged in the 1970s. And here I'm returning to Iraq. Because through our destruction of Iraq, we get something like a keyhole view of how this process has unfolded, how the final phase of the Cold War produced a more violent, more unequal world economic system, one that is maintained not by a world policeman, but a world empire. In the 1940s and early 1950s, if an American opened her newspaper up in the morning or in the afternoon, and she saw a story about a place called Iraq, she likely saw one of three kinds of stories: articles about oil discoveries, articles about archaeological discoveries, and, of course, articles about Iraq's importance in the Cold War with the Soviet Union. A Newswire article from April 3, 1946, about a month after Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, is a good example of this latter genre. Its headline was "Iraq's Corridor to Persian Gulf Valuable to Reds." And it is the first entry in the link I mentioned earlier, by the way, that you guys should have. And I guess if this is posted online, I'll make sure it's in the description. And at this time, in the afterglow of World War II, it was actually Iran, Iraq's neighbor to the east, which was the hotter, more serious Cold War battleground. While the political fortunes of Iraqi communists waxed and waned with Soviet influence, these were, broadly speaking, not especially good years for Iraqis, despite rising revenues from Iraqi oil. Strikes by industrial workers were suppressed, and the Iraqi monarchy, supported by the British, remained in place. According to one account, quote, "Between 1939 and 1957, the cost of living in Iraq increased fivefold. 80% of the population were illiterate, 90% of women, while less than one-fifth of all Iraqi children went to school. There was one doctor for every 60,000 people and one nurse for every 12,000. There was no form of social security, and the percentage of undernourished people rose from 33 in 1949 to 56 in 1957. In his book Carbon Democracy, which I understand is being reissued pretty soon by Verso, Timothy Mitchell perfectly illustrates the perversity of the situation. Among the four large oil-producing countries of the Middle East in that period, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, Iraq's situation was peculiar. It was the country where the companies that controlled the world's major oil regions least wanted to produce more of it. For oil companies that were seeking to maximize profit, getting as much of the oil out of the ground as possible has never been the best strategy. Oversupply means that oil prices can get depressed. What the oil companies need then is control. In those days, Iraq served as what was called a swing producer. It was used by the oil cartel to correct a market glut or a market drought. And in 1958, after years of chronic undersupply from the perspective of Iraq's people, in 1958, the Iraqi monarchy was overthrown in a revolution. The king and his uncle were shot by rebels in the palace gardens. A revolutionary current, Arab and nationalist, inspired by Nasser in Egypt, was running through the region. And in Iraq, the man of the moment, or rather the general of the moment, was General Abd al-Karim Qasim. Now, it was Ghanaian president Kwame Nkrumah who most clearly formulated the practice of neocolonialism. With traditional imperial relations going out of fashion at the dawn of the 20th century, Nkrumah identified neocolonialism as the means by which those imperial powers could maintain control, no matter the cost. The Iraq Petroleum Company, which was the Western-owned Iraqi oil monopoly, not to be confused with the Iraqi Petroleum Group, which was the actual just corporate layers. So Iraq's oil industry was under the thumb of the West, in short, and Iraqi economic growth was thus tightly managed. And Iraq, as the swing producer, and in the high growth, 1950s and 60s, it was actually sort of a perennial concern that too much oil production would crash prices and fuck what were called the Seven Sisters, the American oil cartel, or the Western oil cartel, rather. And the July 1958 military coup that installed General Qasim can be seen as a response to this reality. It was followed by an improvement in relations between Iraq and the Soviet Union, and yet more tension between Iraq and the West. And this time also, by the way, there was 3 years after the revolution, in 1961, the creation of Kuwait, supported by now Iraq's rival, Egypt, whose 100 miles of shoreline were the other only thing separating Iraq's Persian Gulf shores from Saudi Arabia, its other main rival. And it was actually found out, right, the journalists Adel Darwish and Gregory Alexander, quote, it was found out years later that Qasim had drawn up plans, most of which were implemented by Saddam in 1990 to annex Kuwait by coup. And Qasim's National Front government included communists. And in the Western world, Iraq was seen as calamitously now falling under Soviet influence. In March 1959, Qasim had taken Iraq out of the so-called Baghdad Pact, the major treaty that aligned America-friendly powers like Turkey and Iraq against the Soviet Union. In the words of literally the U.S. State Department's website, quote, similar to NATO and the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the main purpose of the Baghdad Pact was to prevent communist incursions and to foster peace in the Middle East. It failed miserably. That's me. The Soviet Union stepped up support for the Iraqi government, and this was a tradition of military aid that would last for 20 years, even as killing Iraqi communists went in and out of fashion for the Iraqi government. And 2 months after the Baghdad Pact withdrawal, in May 1959, and this is also in the link, an editorial in a newspaper in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan, of all places, the Leader Post in Regina, ran with the title, The Tragedy of Iraq. And you can find it in that guide. And it gives you an idea, I think, of how, as the 1960s dawned, Iraq was understood by people in the West in the mainstream press when it was talked about politically. In Blowback Season 1, we provide an overview of the attempts that start to come about on Qasim's life. Economic reforms, a fresh set of revolts in Kurdistan, in northern Iraq, and Qasim's coolness towards the Arabs' leading revolutionary Nasser, it made him a lot of enemies from the jump. And his efforts to take over the Iraqi Petroleum Company's drilling and exploration rights essentially sealed his fate. The Iraqi Ba'ath Party, in particular, drew strength from all these developments. In February 1963, with assistance from the CIA, although the extent of that remains debated forever, the Ba'athists, supported by military officers, successfully overthrew Qasim, who was killed in a firing squad. And after the liquidation of yet even more communists, the military officers elbowed out the Ba'athists and then ran the country as an unstable military dictatorship under their thumb until 1968. Of all the Arab states that had been created by the West and the former colonial powers, it was Iraq that had actually turned out to be the most durable as a national entity. Its dominant ethnic groups could peacefully share power, anchored by a capital city rivaled only in the Arab world by Cairo. There was a palpable sense of Iraqi nationhood, in contrast to the Gulf monarchies that we also supported, which are, generally speaking, family-run autocracies maintained to this day by armies and police castes that are imported from Muslim countries further east, like Pakistan. In 1968, the military government in Iraq buckled, and the Ba'athists retook control. The Arab-Israeli War of 1967 had again altered the political terrain of the Middle East, this time weakening the prestige and credibility of all its Arab belligerents, as Israel succeeded in demonstrating the regional military superiority that it possesses to this day. Nasser fell the hardest, but the shock was also felt in Baghdad, despite the Iraqis' limited involvement. The coming years, however, saw only more challenges to Western hegemony, not fewer. In Libya, a 1969 revolution installed Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and shortly thereafter removed the U.S. military base in that country. And Ba'athist Iraq in 1972 began nationalizing its oil industry, a process that would both speed up the development of its own national economy, as well as positioning to make Iraq a major player in the Arab oil embargo that was to begin in the 1970s with further wars against Israel. Throughout the 1970s, the Iraqi economy expanded at a steady clip, growing between 15% and 20% per annum for most of the decade. Although Iraq would soon come to play a major role on the side of the Americans during the twilight of the Cold War, it was during these early years of relative Ba'athist success and alliance with the Soviet Union that we can locate America's strategic antagonism to a strong Iraq. I've referenced a bunch of times to Darwish and Alexander's book Unholy Babylon, and I will do so again here. Quote, although opponents of the Ba'ath regime, as well as former Ba'ath party members, argued that in reality, that the Ba'ath never posed a threat to Israel and never took an active part in the Arab-Israeli wars, a combination of Ba'athist rhetoric and pro-Israel lobbying convinced Washington that a Ba'ath-ruled Iraq was incompatible with a lasting peace between Israel and its neighbors. In other words, as long as the Ba'ath ruled Iraq, then that country could never have a real and lasting alliance with the U.S. Before we leave the 1970s behind, we're going to have to talk briefly about 1979. That summer, Saddam Hussein officially took control of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. And a few months later, Iranian revolutions led by Shia Islamic fundamentalists took down the government of the Shah. Not long after, Sunni radicals, inspired by the Iranian goings-on, took control of the Great Mosque in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, unable to dislodge their religious radical rebels on their own, had to fly in French commandos to violently dislodge and resolve the situation. And we go into more detail on these events in our new season of Blowback. But suffice it to say that the Carter administration in Washington now saw itself as staring down two major world enemies. As before, Soviet communism. But now, added to the list, anti-American Islamism. And this required rethinking America's friends and enemies. Although the notion remained very discreet for nearly a year, writes then NSC official Howard Teacher, by the spring of 1980, National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and others in government and the media began to suggest publicly that Iraq was the logical successor to Iran as the dominant military power in the Persian Gulf. The time had come for Washington and Baghdad to forge a new relationship. Indeed, in April, Brzezinski stated on national TV, Brzezinski stated on national TV that he saw no fundamental incompatibility of interests between the U.S. and Iraq, end quote. And I want to stay in this geopolitical perspective for just a moment longer. Now, despite what Brzezinski said, it is clear that for decades, the U.S. and Iraqi relationship was largely defined by incompatibility. After all, it was the Soviet Union that had been Iraq's primary military benefactor. But overnight, the Iranian military that had been the linchpin of the American strategy in the Persian Gulf, well, that was now in the hands of probably the most vocally anti-American government on the planet. And Saddam Hussein's Iraq, after another 1979 oil shock, Iraq began singing Washington's tune. By the time Iraq unilaterally abrogated the Algiers Accords and invaded Iran in September 1980, writes Howard Teacher, Iraqi oil production had reached nearly 4 million barrels per day, second only to the production of the Saudis. Whatever Saddam may have himself believed over the next decade, as he was personally courted by Reagan official Donald Rumsfeld and given the key to the city of Detroit, it was all contingent entirely on the USA's greater distaste for Iranian fundamentalism over Iraqi nationalism. Henry Kissinger's unfortunately pithy remark summed up America's strategic ambivalence. A pity they both can't lose. And as the Carter White House passed its baton to the Reagans, this new policy for Iraq took on an appropriately hesitant name, the tilt to Iraq. It was a position concretized in National Security Decision Directive 114, which is also in that link. And it's a kind of direct order, which was signed by Reagan, outlining the policy. As the longest conventional war of the 20th century, the Iran-Iraq war was made possible with a global network of supply, rivaled at the time only by Operation Cyclone, the CIA program to arm the Afghan Mujahideen. The U.S., the United Kingdom, France, West Germany, Belgium, Chile, South Africa, and other countries all had a hand in supplying this 1980s war zone. To make that armament campaign possible, America had to change its formal approach to Iraq, even if the country was to be kept at arm's length because of its hostility to Israel and its past support for other anti-American causes. In 1982, Iraq was removed from the American list of state sponsors of terror. The following year, a classified State Department document recommended using the private sector to send financing to Iraq, backed up by the U.S. government through a Department of Agriculture loan program. But directly sending equipment to Iraq would be problematic. As a 1986 cable to the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad noted, any such transfer has to be notified to the Congress and thus made public. And like in Iran-Contra, in which congressional notification of arms shipments had also been required, had it not been just strictly disallowed, there was no congressional notification. And the private sector more than took its cue from Washington. The U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, set up in 1985, included Bechtel, General Motors, Westinghouse, and Mobil Oil, among other corporations. In October 1988, notes reporter Peter Mantias, the group's leader, quote, wrote President Reagan to urge opposition to a U.S. Senate bill that would have imposed economic sanctions against Iraq punishment for imposed economic sanctions against Iraq as punishment for its slaughter by poison gas of thousands of Iraqi Kurds. As a brief aside, although Saddam was ultimately executed in the 2000s for the gassing of the Kurds, CIA files show that the Americans helped Saddam gas Iranians that same year. And after the Israelis had bombed the nuclear reactor at Osirak in 1981, and that had been nicknamed, by the way, Oshirak, for France's Jacques Chirac, by the way, for the French hand in building it, after the Israelis bombed Osirak, Saddam needed nuclear material, and American corporations were willing to provide it. But there was still so much red tape. International laws against sending things like cluster bombs or nuclear detonators to regimes like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. So Saddam created what investigators later called a procurement network, a world-spanning array of front companies for the Iraqi government, manufacturers and shell corporations whose job was to find Saddam whatever his military needed. And so long as Saddam's Iraq was fighting the Iranians, then everything was kosher. The racket got harder to keep going after Iran-Contra. It became impossible, however, in 1990. The global economic slowdown at the end of the 1980s, combined with the financial toll of his war of decade against Iran, had left Iraq in a financial bind. Regardless of whether you believe that the U.S. gave Saddam an outright green light to invade Kuwait, or merely that the U.S. didn't do enough to stop him, his autumn 1990 invasion officially and squarely put Hussein's Iraq in the American enemy's camp once more. Multiple investigations during the time of the George H.W. Bush administration turned up grisly details about how American companies had larded up Saddam with weapons. The facts were inconvenient to Bush, whose senior deputies had arranged multiple conduits of support for Iraq. A small Italian bank in Atlanta, BNL, had supplied hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. Ag Department credits that had been used for weapons, including, as it turned out, nuclear materiel. Saddam's procurement network had reached from England right into heartland America, including the town of Ceylon in eastern Ohio, as well as where there was actually an FBI raid, as well as Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Now, this small Italian bank risked becoming an election liability for Bush, much like Iran-Contra, or even Bush's arrest of former CIA agent Panama's Manuel Noriega, as there was now also strong evidence that tied Bush directly to the secret plot to arm the Contras. And the fingerprints of Bush's chief deputies remained all over the agricultural subsidies that had been used to finance weapons purchases. In fact, one H.W. Bush attorney general, former Pennsylvania Governor Dick Thornburgh, was himself connected to one of the companies most strongly implicated in what was now being called the Iraqgate mess. In short, Bush needed a cover-up artist to help him out of this predicament, and badly. The reporter Peter Mantius, who wrote a very good book about this scandal, Shell Game, he wrote a letter a few years ago, unpublished, during the Trump years. After seeing Donald Trump's Attorney General William Barr climb back to power, 30 years after serving as Attorney General for H.W., Mantius felt compelled to write something down about the key role that William Barr had played in killing off what was Iraqgate. Barr was the guy whom H.W. had called in to be Attorney General after Thornburgh. Mantius shared the letter with me. Here's a passage. Al Gore began tying Bush to the arming of Iraq a few weeks before the 92 election. Meanwhile, three Democratic committee chairs in Congress, banking, judiciary, and intelligence, were pressuring Barr to call for a court-appointed independent counsel in the case. Barr said no. Finally, to deflect the heat, he appointed ex-judge Frederick Lacy to look into BNL and to report to him after the election. Lacy had glaring conflicts of interest that were unknown at the time and are still rarely mentioned. A month after the election, Lacy completed a thorough whitewash and told Barr a court-appointed independent counsel was unnecessary. Barr agreed. The scandal was diffused. Now, for those who remember the Trump years and Barr's successful role as serving a kind of body man attorney general for the president, now you know where he cut his teeth 30 years back, cleaning up after Poppy Bush and the CIA. History repeating itself for sure. Now, I'm going to wind this talk down and just say that this all may seem like it's esoteric history, but it's not. After the 92 election, members of Congress digging into the scandal, they hoped that they might get support for this from the Clinton administration. But any such excitement was quashed in 1994, if not already in 93, and the full extent of Bush's and the CIA's role in establishing, maintaining, financing, and wrapping up Saddam's procurement network remains murky. On the very day that victory was declared in Operation Desert Storm, Dick Thornburgh had actually handed down what he called the mother of all indictments, a 100-plus count charge sheet against a junior banker in Atlanta whom he had claimed masterminded the entire Saddam financing scheme of the 1980s. Media bought it. And I bring all this up 20 years after the 2003 invasion because the people who went unpunished in arming Saddam and thus provided the pretext, the literal pretext, the reason that we went in 2003, the weapons, including nuclear development technology, we had supplied it. And those corporations that had made it went completely unpunished. There was congressional testimony alleging CIA agents were working undercover for manufacturers spanning Pennsylvania to Kentucky. And these leads were not followed up on substantially after 1994. I think the main reason I wanted to talk about this today was because the reality has not changed. The American government and the structure of our economy is still completely dependent on war. What limited industrialization and reindustrialization we may be on the verge of seeing with the Green New Deal will again be contingent on, you know, spending it, developing it, refining it through a state that only knows how to, you know, I guess, conceive of these sorts of massive expenditures, you know, whether it's geopolitics or climate or anything, through the prism of the military. And in these moments when we make, you know, I suppose, major international commitments to allies, or we, you know, are in this process now of, you know, a supposed decoupling, a very messy period of global conflict that seems like we may be at the precipice of, I think it's wise to take a look at the historical record and look at all of the people who have lined their pockets at every step of the way, who have done their part to make sure that their corporations, their portfolios have remained untouched despite constant tumult, despite changes in White House administrations. And there is, you know, there's a lot more to this story. But I think that if we're to sort of, you know, think at all about the future and avoiding repeating the sins of the past, then I suppose that, you know, to me, this is a pretty insightful place to look about the kinds of mistakes that we may be making again. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.